Hey y'all, before we get started for today's episode, I had a quick shout out to do and plus a little bit of a bit of an advertisement that I wanted to push through. So first off, shout out, wanted to give a shout out to Nude Van Harskamp. I probably completely just butchered his name, but if you're listening, sir, I apologize. But he was so gracious in providing the music for and allowed me to use his music for today's episode. And you will listen to what you will hear in just a moment here. So, check out his YouTube video. Check out his you know, website. You know, got a lot of great music over there. Check it out. Nude N O U D Van V A N Harskamp H A R S K A M P on YouTube, as well as on Spotify, and basically anywhere else you can get to your music. And second blurb that I wanted to, this is more of an advertisement. For those of you that have not watched or maybe have not seen or anybody that's listening, I'm pretty sure a lot of people that are listening to this have listened to my previous episode, but if you have not listened to my previous episode, it's The Night of the Living Dead. I highly recommend going on to the YouTube, to my YouTube channel and checking out that video, because it does contain the actual Night of the Living Dead film with my commentary recorded over it. I'm really excited about that. I'm really trying to push people to go watch that, because I think it's really something pretty awesome. So anyway, that's all I got. Let us start the episode. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Movie Commentary Podcast. It's the podcast in which we are watching movies and talking about movies. And today we're going to conclude the month of October by watching the movie that is, I think, most associated with the day that this is being released. I am, of course, talking about 1978's Halloween, directed by John Carpenter. And I immediately knew from the beginning of the month that I wanted to release Halloween on the episode of regarding Halloween on Halloween. Now, this is the 1978 version of Halloween. This is not Rob Zombie's remake of 2007. This is not the 2018 rebootquel that John Carpenter was involved with. No, this is the original 1978 horror slasher, you know, icon starring Jamie Lee Curtis and Donald Pleasance. And without much further ado, of course, also, and I will stress this enough, if you have not watched this movie, A, spoiler alert, and B, please go stop this podcast and go watch the movie and then come back, or if you'd like to watch the movie over the commentary over the podcast, do that as well. Either way, I'm going to go ahead and get it started. And I will admit, Halloween is probably my favorite introduction of a film ever, to be quite honest with you. I mean, it's one of the, it follows the 1970s tropes of, you know, the having your opening credits before the film starts. But you also have, like, you know, the black, it's a black, like, background with, like, the orange lettering. And then, you know, it says John Carpenter's Halloween. And, you know, there's obviously a jack-o'-lantern kind of kind of to the side there. And the music, obviously the music puts it over the top. The music of Halloween, all of it, is actually scored by John Carpenter himself. He was basically the jack of all trades in this movie. He essentially was the director, the writer, he basically edited the film as well, part editor, and he's also, you know, composed the film, and, you know, it kind of goes together with a bit of its slapstick. Like slapstick, not slapstick, like a ragtag kind of production crew, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it's actually kind of an interesting, if you kind of look at it in a musical time, it's actually a 5/4 time. It's got like like five beats per, like, you know, measure per line of, you know, music. So I mean, a lot of times when you listen to music, it's got like four beats per, like, note, four beats per bar. It's like, but this one's got like the five beats. So this is the opening title here. So one of the interesting things is that I always kind of thought about it, but then I finally, somebody kind of pointed out to me, it was so the jack-o'-lantern that is kind of at the side of the film here, at the side of the title cards, they kind of zoom into it, and then as you get kind of closer to it, you kind of go up to the nose and to the eye of the jack-o'-lantern, and then you can kind of see that it looks like a figure, like a head with like kind of frizzled hair holding like a knife and that kind of thing. And somebody has told me that that looks like Michael Myers holding the knife, which I kind of agree with on that. So we're starting off Halloween night, 1963, in Haddonfield, Illinois. So this is the opening shot right here. We're looking at the Myers house. And this entire scene, it's actually, it's constructed to look like one shot. The opening scene is essentially of a little Michael Myers kind of basically offing his sister. But the way that the scene is set up is it's set up in a way that it's supposed to be like one continuous take. And as I will get into this film, I mean, it's, you know, you don't ever see that on such a low budget film like Halloween. And, you know, there are films, shots that are even extremely hard to, you know, honestly do, you know, even with a big budget film. But what's also interesting, there's a couple interesting things about this is that this scene utilizes a recently invented camera system called the Steadicam. And you kind of heard me talk about the Steadicam kind of in the Shining podcast, but they used it in this film quite a bit, actually. In fact, John Carpenter said he used it compulsively. And the technical term for the system that they used in this film was actually called Panaglide, which is the because they filmed this movie using Panavision-like cameras and Panavision lenses, you know, using, like, really good lenses and that kind of thing. And the Panavision kind of equivalent to the to Steadicam was the Panaglide. So it's, you know, you get some of these scenes right here where, you know, it's kind of nice and glidey, kind of smooth shots. Except this scene here, this is Deborah Hill, the producer's hand, reaching out into the drawer and getting the knife, and the hand kind of goes out of focus for a little bit, and you can kind of notice that it's one of those, like, you know, low-budget production kind of things, like, oh, the shot's out of frame, shot's out of focus for a little bit, but I think it also kind of adds to a little bit of the aura of the film or something like that. And what's also interesting about this house that we're in is that it's actually it was actually, at the time that they were filming this, in the spring of 1978, it actually was basically a dilapidated old house, I think, in Los Angeles or, you know, in Southern California somewhere. And for the most part of the movie, the house is portrayed as, like, you know, a dilapidated old, you know, rundown house that, you know, nobody's going to be in. But for this scene here, this whole one shot kind of take thing was actually shot on the last day of filming. Literally the entire last day of filming was dedicated for this one shot. And while they were doing it, they literally had to, like, what Jamie Lee Curtis would say is whitewash the house. They literally would have to go around with, like, you know, they would have to, like, paint the house to make it look 15 years younger. They'd have to put, like, you know, like, different parts of, like, wallpaper up and kind of, you know, make it look nicer and that kind of thing. So as we peer into Judith Myers' room, and Michael has currently put on a mask. And that's something kind of cool that they did with the camera here. They kind of put, like, a little, like, mask with, like, two eyelids on. It's because it's a POV shot. And then he's going to stab in his sister there, so. I believe that the kid that plays I believe that the hand in a lot of these scenes here is actually Deborah Myers' Deborah Hill's hand. And Deborah Hill she's the producer of Halloween. She actually was she was also the co-writer of Halloween, and she also was, at the time, John Carpenter's girlfriend. Unfortunately, she has since passed away due to colon cancer. passed away about 15 years ago, but that was kind of her hand in several of these scenes here. And so we're going to come out of the house to Michael's parents. They're going to rip the mask off, and this is looking at, I believe, Will Sandin, who... This is the only scene that he's in the entire film, and they rip the mask off, and John Carpenter even said they hired a crane for the shot to kind of pull out from the house and look to see that, it was just a little kid that just killed his sister. It's kind of shocking that you see it's only like a kid that's 6 years old that just killed his, big sister. And it's kind of funny, one of the things that Will Sandin talked about when looking back on this film is that it apparently when they were ripping the mask off and the parents came up and ripped the mask off, apparently it kind of would hurt his face all the time, and he kind of was like, that's the hardest part of the scene is not getting the mask not to hurt. So we're going forward in about 15 years to October 30th, 1978. Okay, of course, because the film is titled Halloween, and, we got to be set basically on or near Halloween, so... And I believe, so we're now introduced to Donald Pleasence playing Dr. Sam Loomis, who, bit of a nod to the horror genre in Psycho. In the movie Psycho, he's actually named after the character in Psycho named Sam Loomis, who I think was Marion Crane's, I think, boyfriend or something like that. Now, it's actually kind of interesting getting Donald Pleasence. He got involved with the film... basically because his daughter was in a band, I believe in London, and his daughter had seen one of John Carpenter's previous films called Assault on Precinct 13, in which John Carpenter, again, had done the music for the film. His daughter really liked the music of Assault on Precinct 13, and basically that was how he got involved with the film. And he basically did it as a favor to his daughter. And his salary for the film was actually the highest budget item on the film. The film originally was budgeted at $300,000, which even for the time was making it for pennies. And then when they got in Donald Pleasence, they actually had to basically raise that budget up to $325,000 because his salary, and I kid you not, I think it was his salary for like less than a week's worth of pay was about $25,000. And that was the biggest budget item that, they spent on the entire film. And he's talking to his, I believe it's Nancy Stevens playing Marion Chambers, the nurse. I could have got that wrong. You can kind of, you obviously tell something's not going right because they have the music start to play and Dr. Loomis is starting to get really nervous and all that kind of stuff. You see they pull up to the gate and they see that it's kind of, basically the gate's busted in, and then we're going to look at Marion Chambers in the car, and then somebody hops on the roof. Oh my goodness. It's one of like those funny, freaky sound effects that I think John Carpenter was involved with. Like, this film's got some good sound design, actually. And then Michael Myers on top of the car is attacking Nurse Chambers. And he also... smashes the window in here. This scene is actually kind of funny because the person that played Michael Myers, he actually he's wearing a robe, a hospital gown, and when they filmed this scene at night, it was, I think the temperature he said was about 40-50 degrees, and when they filmed it, they actually it's a rainy sequence, so they literally turned some hoses on them in order to get, the rain effects there. And apparently the guy that played him, who I'll get into the guy later, I don't want to give away his name right now, but he was thinking, like, man, that was one of the most painful parts of the production in my eyes. And then John Carpenter was kind of like, nah, I would never hurt him, do anything like that. So now we cut back to Haddonfield. on Halloween. I'm kind of following the title card there. It's actually kind of interesting. The name Haddonfield is actually a bit of an Easter egg. It's actually the town that Deborah Hill, the producer of the film, that's where she was born, and you know the town that she grew up in. Of course, that Haddonfield wasn't in Illinois. It's actually in New Jersey. So, and now we're looking at the Strode House, where we'll meet Laurie Strode, played by Jamie Lee Curtis. Apparently, this house actually still exists in Southern California, and apparently, this house has a little like shrine to Jamie Lee Curtis. Basically saying, like, yeah, this is Laurie Strode's house from the movie Halloween, that kind of thing. Because, again, this movie was shot entirely in Southern California. Parts of the scene were shot, I think, in Los Angeles, and I think some scenes were shot in West Hollywood or in Hollywood or something like that. And, you know, basically because it's, like, that's probably, like, the cheapest areas to, like, film for these guys. Because, again, $300,000 with the budget, I mean, don't have a whole lot of, you know, spending room kind of per se. So it's actually kind of funny kind of how this film somewhat got started, kind of the origins of Halloween here. So basically, as I'm talking right now, Laurie Strode's basically just kind of walking the streets right now, but or kind of walking on the sidewalk, but essentially the idea started with a film distributor who's trying to get into film production came named Irwin Yablons, who essentially had the idea to make just like a horror film, because he basically thought that, yeah, horror films are cheap and they can sell easy. So he was trying to make like a quick buck from this film. And he had seen John Carpenter's movie Assault on Precinct 13, and he'd wanted to make a movie with him because he had seen that John Carpenter, this guy can make a movie basically with a really low budget. So that's kind of how it started. And John Carpenter, at the time, he wasn't interested, but at the same time, he was like, well, it's work, so I'll take it, because he actually attended the very prestigious USC Film School, which is, I think, probably one of the best film schools in the entire country. And basically, Irwin Yablons was the guy that came up with the idea of putting setting the film on Halloween, and, you know, basically making it basically about a psycho killer killing babysitters, that kind of thing. And it's actually kind of an interesting story, because up until this point there was no film that was titled Halloween, let alone set on the date of Halloween or had the theme of Halloween as a part of it. So this film, in a bit of a sense, is a bit of a trendsetter. Of course, as far as also, you know, on top of it's like, you know, basically, like, you know, on top of it, like, you know, popularizing like slasher genres and the slasher, you know, kind of, you know, genre. I mean, this film isn't the first slasher film, but it's the film that really popularized various tropes of the slasher genre. And, you know, we'll get into some of those a little bit later there. Now, this scene is really interesting, because it actually kind of because the character that is talking to Donald Pleasant, Sam Loomis, is named Dr. Sam Wynn, who doesn't appear until the sequel Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, and at that point it's actually played by a different actor. And then once we get to that point, it's it's just, you know, nobody really cares at that point. But it's just kind of an interesting tidbit, because you don't really even get to meet that character or even know that character, and he kind of comes back in a big way in the sixth movie. That's something I'll kind of get into as the movie goes along here. The franchise of Halloween has a very interesting history regarding its timeline and regarding its, like, you know, the sequels and the production of its sequels and, like, the reboots of the timeline and all that kind of stuff. So now we have an interesting, creepy scene here in which Laurie is in class, and like a lot of students, she's looking out the window, and she sees a man in a very creepy white mask looking at her. I kind of like how Halloween they show you Michael Myers They kind of show you the character, but then they don't. They do a good job of also kind of like hiding him and making him mysterious and really, you're not giving you like a really good look at him until quite later on in the film. Actually, I mean, you only kind of see him from essentially a lot of these in this scene coming up here, kind of the neck down. So it's kind of interesting. So, and now we're with a little Tommy Doyle, who is basically getting bullied, and he's like, you know, the kids are like, you know, the boogeyman's gonna get you, the boogeyman's gonna get you, which, you know, Tommy Doyle's gonna be, you know, of course, Tommy Doyle, and so, they actually just trip Tommy, and they, and he smashed the pumpkin up there. And then one of the kids runs into Michael Myers, known as the Shape. Actually, that was one of the things that they kind of talked about in the. You never really reference him kind of by Michael Myers, except basically that, you know, that you heard that the parents called him Michael in the earlier part of the film, and then you kind of saw that later, learned that his sister name is Judith Myers, so you kind of put two and two together. Now his name's Michael Myers, so. However, it's kind of interesting, like, in the credits of the film, the character is actually credited as The Shape, and that's actually what a lot of the cast and crew kind of referred to him as, is basically The Shape. So, yeah, that's basically that. And we're kind of, this is actually a really interesting scene here. We're actually in the back seat of, the kind of the car that Michael's stolen earlier. You can see that Michael's still driving the car that he stole earlier in the film. And it's actually kind of interesting. It's one of the kind of the, I don't know if it's a plot hole. It's kind of always like a plot question that people ask is, how has he been locked up in an insane asylum, not in a sanatorium, because he's locked up in the Smith's Grove Sanatorium, basically for his entire, almost entire upbringing from age 6 to 21, 22, 23, yet he knows how to drive, and he can drive like over 150 miles to Haddonfield, Illinois, and get there, you know, quickly and that kind of thing. So yeah, and this scene's really interesting. This is kind of the origin of how Michael got his coveralls, essentially. He you can tell that, you know, he basically kind of hijacked this repairman's car and essentially killed him. So you can tell that he's been here because Dr. Loomis picks up a matchbook that was in the car that Michael Myers was in, and then also you can tell he's got his hospital robes that were there, and then he also see that there was a guy kind of hidden in the grasses there that had been kind of offed. So that's kind of a bit of a slight, kind of funny there. So this is coming up on this scene here. This is a scene right here in which basically Laurie Strode, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, is going to be walking home with her friends. This is Linda Vanderklok, played by PJ Souls, who had actually made a name for herself in the film Carrie, the Brian De Palma film Carrie. And apparently John Carpenter was just so enthralled by the way how she said totally, and she says totally almost in all of her, you know, almost all of her lines. It's kind of funny. And then this is Nancy Keyes playing Annie Brackett, who's actually the daughter of Sheriff Lee Brackett in the film. And it's actually kind of funny. She was at one point at the time, she was actually married to the production designer and the editor of the film, Tommy Lee Wallace. They've actually since divorced. Although it's kind of interesting, I never really understood the reason why, but she got, in the film was credited as Nancy Loomis. I don't know, I never understood that, but so. So, kind of going on Jamie Lee Curtis here in the film. I mean, obviously, you know, nowadays she's very well regarded actress. You know, very accomplished career. A lot of accolades, awards. You know, kind of to her name. But you know, when this film started, the only thing that she really had going for her was that her mom was Janet Lee, who played the character Marion Crane in Psycho, basically the character in Psycho that got offed in the shower. So, that was kind of really the only kind of claim to fame that she had had at the time. I mean, I think at the time Jamie Lee Curtis had done a few television shows and a bit of acting in television, but you know, nothing. I mean, nothing really major. You know, she wasn't obviously not nearly as famous now, but of course, it was really this film that really put her on the map. And you know, at the time, originally she was kind of billed as the Scream Queen, kind of after her mother, you know, Janet Leigh. So, now this scene actually gets kind of, it gets some praise by a lot of, like, kind of fans of, I know that Jamie Lee Curtis, because I've watched the commentary of Halloween with Jamie Lee Curtis and John Carpenter, and one of the things that they really like about this is that they're the girls kind of talking with each other sounds like how, you know, teenagers would talk. Of course, you know, this film is about 40 years old, and, you know, that kind of hasn't aged very well. I mean, of course, you know, it's, you know, new generations, you know, kids talk a different way. But, you know, at the time, I mean, it was, you know, that's how people thought, that's how teenagers talked. The film, again, was co-written by Deborah Hill and John Carpenter. And Deborah Hill, you know, who herself, you know, was, you know, very young, you know, a very young woman, you know, went into the film as, you know, one of the production, as the, you know, one of the main producers. And, you know, she knew, you know, how, you know, young women talked, you know, how high schoolers, you know, would talk and that kind of thing. So, you know, she was the one that really penned a lot of that dialogue. So, now again, we get a really good look at the shape. I call him the Shape. You know, he's, you know, now known as Michael Myers, but in the time it was basically the Shape. So, and he kind of hides behind the bushes here. This is one of the famous scenes in the movie where he basically just hides behind the bushes, kind of stalking Lori there. And it's kind of funny because Annie Brackett's gonna be kind of like, this guy wants to take you out, and then Lori's gonna come up and be like, "Yeah, you scared another one away. Oh my gosh!" And because I mean, Laurie Strode, and I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis kind of portrays Lori as a bit of a kind of a goody two shoes kind of girl, you know, not a whole lot of not really getting a whole lot of guys, and you know, kind of that kind of thing. So, and kind of her friends are a little bit more, you know, promiscuous and that kind of thing. So. It was actually kind of really interesting kind of movie mistake here because in that scene in which there was a shot in which Annie was looking at Lori and like, this guy wants to take you out tonight. And there was actually, it was really slight, but there was a shot of like secondhand smoke from like cigarette smoke kind of coming back from, coming into the frame there, and that was actually John Carpenter's like cigarette smoke in the scene there. And if you look really closely, you can kind of see just like a puff of smoke just going left or right on the camera frame there. And it was kind of, I always wondered why, you know, John Carpenter never, you know, reshot that scene. But of course, he kind of took a bit of a brazen attitude towards the, towards it, you know, in one of the documentaries that they talked about it. So, now this is actually really funny. They're actually showing like kids starting to trick or treat. Of course, it's Halloween and starting to show kids trick or treating and that kind of thing. And I always thought it seems a little bit too early to trick or treat. I'd always thought you'd start when it would be like, you know, 6 o'clock at night or something like that. And it seems like it's like 4 p.m. here. And I was like, I never knew that they would trick or treat and that kind of thing. So, at least that early. Of course, I don't know. So, And one thing that you notice in this film, if you really watch it, is that there is a lack of extras in the film. Basically, during those scenes in which Laurie and her friends were walking on the street, there was basically just them walking. There was nobody else walking around them. And, of course, you know, this film being $325,000 budget, I mean, they didn't have enough money to in order to pay the extras, and so they basically just kind of had to pay those main characters plus some of the side characters, and it really adds to, again, like, kind of that, I don't want to say the sense of isolation, cuz, like, we're in a suburban area, with, houses around, there's people inside those houses all over the place, but it kind of adds a bit of an eerie kind of setting to the film, I think, in a kind of way. Of course, Laurie is starting to get a little anxious now because she's getting calls and nobody's answering, so... Oh my gosh. You know, the interesting thing about Halloween is and this is kind of a film nerd. Me kind of finding things to talk about while watching this film. But going back to it, Halloween cost $325,000 to make, which at the time was extremely low budget. You know, you try and make a film for that now, I mean, that's basically making it for like pennies and that kind of thing. And you know, back in the day, that was, of course, a really small budget. And when they were making the film, they actually did their best to try and... One of the things that they said was, spend money where it counts. And basically what that meant was, when they were making the film, the things that they used to kind of make the film and kind of like the post-production, like, kind of mixing and kind of the part of the film is... I'm really sounding confusing while saying this, but basically, they did. John Carpenter wanted. There was two things that. There was three things that he wanted to know, and I know only about two of these things. He wanted the film to be shot in Panavision, which back in the day was kind of like really great, widescreen lenses that you would shoot films on, with great film stock. And he wanted the film to be processed, once the actual film to be processed at MGM Labs, which is one of the best, film processing labs, in the country back in the day. And he also wanted the sound design and the film, like, sound to be kind of basically processed at one of the best sound labs in the country at the time as well. So that's, I think, where quite a bit of the budget went, because you look at the film, I mean, it looks I don't want to say, like millions, but it doesn't look like it was $300,000. I mean, the film itself, if you look at it, it's very minimalistic. That's where the budget, where you can kind of see the cracks in the budget is kind of the minimalism of it. But one of the things that I think this film has going for it, which a lot of other low-budget films don't, is the quality of the film. The use of the Panavision lenses and the Panavision, film stock and the use of the Panaglide and the post production, mixing of the sound and the development of the film really gives it a great looking quality. I mean, it looks about as good as, some of the big budgeted, studio films. And I know that, some people shouldn't really judge films based on its quality, that's kind of like judging a book by its cover, I kind of feel like, but I have watched movies in which the film quality, I've watched low budgeted films in which the film quality is not the greatest, and you can kind of tell that, they kind of skipped out on really spending on making the film look and sound really good. But with this film, you can obviously tell they really wanted the film to look and sound, really good. Obviously, we're watching a restoration of it, because, restoring films and, film back in, not 40 years ago, you want to restore and make it look a little bit nicer nowadays. And now Annie and Laurie are driving on the driving now, and Michael is following them behind. It's kind of funny, Lori's. I kind of feel for Lori in this scene because I think they're smoking a cigarette or they're just smoking a joint here, but they're smoking a joint or smoking a cigarette, and you can see that Lori's having a tough time smoking it because she's just like smoking it and coughing and coughing. And then it's also the scene in which Annie talks to her dad, and you also get this is the familial connection that Annie and her dad are, you know, related. Annie and, you know, Sheriff Brackett are basically related and that kind of thing, so. I love this scene. It's like, you blame everything on kids. I always wonder. I always wondered, like, what Michael used the rope for, because so basically what happened is that Annie and Lori came up to a hardware store and came up to Sheriff Brackett kind of investigating a robbery in a hardware store, and essentially the only things that were stolen were rope, knives, and a Halloween mask, and you know, like, you know, what he does is with the Halloween mask and the knives, obviously, but you never know what he did with the rope. I mean, maybe you could argue in the second half of the film when they're in the house of horrors that Laurie's walking through, you can say, yeah, she probably used the rope there, but, you know, I don't know, something like that. I will admit, though, that the cinematography also of this film, of a low-budget film, is really, you know, the lighting here, especially in some of these scenes, is really quite really quite spectacular, I think. I mean, it's really good lighting, not only here, but throughout the entire film. I mean, you know, the cinematographer, again, this is kind of one of those films where it really launched a lot of careers, and the cinematographer is, you know, one of those examples. So Dean Cundey was the cinematographer. He's basically in charge of how the lighting of the picture and basically the camera operations and making sure that the picture kind of, you know, will look good so that the camera will be able to, you know, pick it up well, you know, pick it up what they want to see, that kind of thing. And he was the cinematographer for this film. He also did Halloween 2, and that was actually interesting because Dean Cundey was offered to do the cinematography work on another low budget horror film called Poltergeist, you know, very famous, you know, horror film, you know, nowadays. But he actually turned that down because he wanted to do the cinematography on Halloween 2, the sequel to, you know, Halloween here, obviously. So, and he later went on to do, you know, be the cinematographer for, you know, franchises such as Back to the Future, and he also did Jurassic Park with Steven Spielberg, and you know, a couple other, you know, good big budget movies. So, I mean, that was, again, Halloween was another film where it really kind of kickstarted his career, and where he really got like kind of a start and that kind of thing. So now. You see, we're finally getting kind of a bit of a close-up, but again, we're kind of seeing a bit of a shot with the masked killer, or the masked stalker as of right now, Michael Myers. And he's kind of just, again, stalking kind of Annie's character there. It's really, so, the character of Michael Myers, or also known as The Shape, is actually played by, not an actor, by trade, by film. It was actually one of John Carpenter's film school buddies, Nick Castle, who played the character of The Shape. And it was always kind of funny because Nick Castle was always really, when John Carpenter first came to him for the idea of the film, he was, I don't really know. I don't really like doing acting. I'm not a real good actor. I get stiff in front of the camera. I was like, no, it's easy. You just wear a mask and shoot the mask. Actually, I should probably get into that as well, because the mask of Michael Myers is actually kind of an interesting is also an interesting story on its own. So Tommy Lee Wallace, who again was the production designer and the editor, Tommy Lee Wallace, again, he also went on to direct Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, which is the only film in the Halloween series that does not involve Michael Myers. And I'm going to look up here, but he also, Tommy Lee Wallace also directed the 1990 miniseries It. That is the one, you know, starring starring Tim Curry as the clown Pennywise. He was the director of that film, as that series. But, you know, he got his start in, you know, production design, and he was the, you know, first person that actually created the mask of Michael Myers. And basically, when he was creating the mask, it called for a mask with a blank, expressionless, you know, basic human features, that kind of thing. So basically, just a really blank and expressionless mask. And apparently the mask that he kind of created, he basically had a Richard Nixon mask that he could choose from, a Spock mask, a Captain Kirk mask from Star Trek, and then they picked up an Emmett Kelly mask, which is like those like sad clown with like the big red nose kind of mask, and they actually went with the Captain Kirk mask, and they went with that mainly because it was the most expressionless mask. It just had a very plain mask with not a whole lot of expression and not a whole lot of features. And essentially what they did was they kind of cut the eye holes out. They yanked the sideburns off, and they basically spray-painted the whole thing white. And that, in a sense, was the creation of the original Michael Myers mask. And in my opinion, the mask in this film is the best mask that is in the Halloween franchise. That's kind of, again, as the film franchise goes on, there's a lot of variation, not only kind of in the styles of films, but also the different timelines, and you know, and it kind of reflects in the masks, even, because you know, Halloween 2 uses the same mask that we use in Halloween 1 here. However, the mask kind of, according to the story, Deborah Hill basically just kind of put the mask under her bed, and it kind of accumulated dust and accumulated, like, it kind of yellowed, and as the latex kind of, you know, aged and that kind of thing. And when they brought it back, the mask essentially had been, you know, very yellowed, and I think some of the hair had, you know, kind of reddened a little bit as well, so. But yeah, and then after that, you know, they kind of started making more masks for the sequels, you know, Halloween 4 on, and I believe now the original mask has decayed beyond being an actual mask. I mean, I think, because I believe that the person that portrayed Michael Myers in the second Halloween film, who is a very famous stunt coordinator by the name of Dick Warlock, he actually kept the mask after the production of Halloween 2, and apparently it just decayed, and it just went to, it got to the point where the mask, like the mouth of the mask, had just kind of like fallen off, and it was just like completely worn away. Oh yeah, here we go with. So here we go. We got Annie and Lori talking to each other on the phone, which they should be, you know, they should be, you know, babysitting, but of course, you know, they're not doing that. And now you can kind of see that there's somebody outside. Obviously, that is the masked stalker. and there's Mike, and then the dog goes outside to kind of go check out what's going on here. Now, let me see here. Okay, yep, there it is. So Annie Brackett is talking to Lori about setting her up with a guy named Ben Tramer, and that will come into play in the that actually is a very interesting tidbit that will happen in the next film, the Halloween 2, because in that film there's actually a very famous scene in the second Halloween film in which a kid dressed up in the very similar Michael Myers outfit basically gets hit by a car, and the car hits like a van and it explodes, and that kid that got killed like that was Ben Tramer. So of course that's also a spoiler alert for Halloween 2, so sorry, that's two spoiler alerts now for this film. It's one of my favorite things about Halloween, about Michael Myers in this film at least, is that he's got a very distinct breathing noise. And of course, that, me personally as a film buff, I'm really, one of my favorite things about films that I kind of geek out about is sound effects and like sound design and that kind of thing. And Michael Myers' breathing is one of my favorite parts of the film because it's a very distinct, like, kind of idea, and obviously as the film goes along, you know, we kind of go into that. This is a sad scene right here. The dog Lester is gonna go outside and meet Michael Myers, and unfortunately, it's not gonna end well for Lester. Oh no. Yeah, it looks like Michael Myers has unfortunately killed that dog. Of course, I don't think any, of course, I'm pretty sure no animals were harmed in the making of this film. However, I did not see that in the end credits of this film. So, a little bit of mystery going on here. Is this what I think it is? I think it might be. Yes, it is. Okay, I'm sorry for that, but so this is really an interesting little Easter egg. Now, the reason that it's interesting is that because this is actually kind of foreshadowing something that's going to happen in the future, actually. So, and trust me, I sound crazy, but I'll get into this. So, we're watching a John Carpenter film. You know, Halloween is John Carpenter's, I'd say, magnum opus of a film, to be quite honest with you. Lori and the kid that she's babysitting, Tommy Doyle, are watching a film called The Thing from Another World, a 1951 film called The Thing from Another World. What's interesting about that is John Carpenter, in 40 years, is going to produce and direct his own adaptation of that same story, basically titled The Thing. And it's really interesting because the title card scene of kind of the thing appearing kind of like through the lights and whatnot, John Carpenter uses that same effect in his film titled The Thing. So it's kind of a bit of future foreshadowing, future Easter egg kind of a vibe with John Carpenter put in the film here. I mean, I think he'd always been a fan of, you know, the film The Thing and the story that originated it. But I'm not sure. I mean, I think he, I'm not sure where that came from. So. Oh, and Lori and Annie is now in her, basically out trying to make... No, no, it's not making anything. She's doing laundry because she spilled basically oil on her clothes making popcorn for her kid that she was babysitting for. So, and then obviously Michael Myers is around, and that was a really interesting trick. I don't know how that door shut on its own. I mean, with Michael Myers not being there. Of course, they probably use, some kind of trick, with like a wire and like, oh, they closed the door, Nick. That's probably how they did it. Well, I mean, shoot, thank you. I remember, so this little girl playing Lindsay Wallace here, she's actually, obviously being a kid nowadays, but I remember there was a bit of it. It was, I remember when in a documentary that they were talking about, I remember she would kind of reference how, man, the film, because like they kind of show her watching a film there, and they kind of, there was, I remember she was talking about how, yeah, I don't really, I always thought that movie that I was watching lasted like for 6 months because of something like that. And Paul Annie's boyfriend is calling Lindsay Wallace there. No, I'm sorry, Lindsay ran out to try and fetch Annie, who's trying to climb out the window of the. It's kind of an interesting thing. Like this family's got like a. This family has like a little like outside shed that has like their their washing machine and dryer and washer and dryer. So that's kind of an interesting house setup. Yeah, some house design with Nick. Yeah, that's what we're gonna do next on this podcast. Oh my gosh! And like Annie Brackett's like, "Oh, promise me you won't tell anybody about this," and she gets like all embarrassed and stuff. I'm not gonna lie. I'm really surprised that Michael didn't come out and kill her. When she was stuck in the window like that. Of course, he's still standing right there in the background, waiting for her to mess up and make his move. So. That's actually really kind of cool, like, by Nick Castle, actually, because, I mean, they shot the scene in real time, and, when they pan away from Michael, like, he gets out of the frame really quickly, it looks like, and I'm really impressed by how, like, they're able to do that, because, I mean, it really, not a whole lot of time to really get it out of the way like that, but... Because I mean, they showed in the film a lot of times, like Michael kind of being there. You look away, you look back. He's not there anymore, and it kind of showed in that scene right there. However, the camera was filming in real time, so basically, when they panned away, Nick Castle would have had to been when it panned back. Nick Castle would have had to be there. If the camera panned away, panned back. Nick Castle would have had to hurry out of the way and GTFO that kind of thing. So. So yeah, and so now Annie's gonna run across the street and basically dump Lindsay Wallace onto Lori, who is already who's already babysitting somebody. So, man, what a great friend, I'm like, I'm gonna dump my the kid I'm supposed to be babysitting onto you, that kind of thing. So. Wow. Oh, man. So, yeah. No, Lori's like, I don't want to go out with Ben Tramer. I'm scared. That kind of, she's nervous, that kind of thing, so. Oh, my gosh, man. What a. I'm not going to lie. I'd, like, middle finger the heck out of my friend on that. I'd be like, screw you, man. No, screw you, Jay. So, yeah. However, unfortunately, we also do know that Annie is making, well, not a bad choice because, you know, we don't even know what's going on here, but, Annie is going, basically going back to that house by herself and, going back to the house by herself and, you know, we obviously know that there's a masked stalker that is on the premises and is more than likely going to, you know, offer her, so that kind of thing, so. You know, it's actually interesting is that these houses, these two houses, I do believe, I think they're in either West Hollywood or, because these two houses that the most of the night scenes of Halloween are taking place at, they're actually at a different location in California than where, you know, the Strode houses was at and then where they shot most of the walking daylight scenes. And from what I know, these houses are still up in Southern California. And of course, I think they've been renovated now. Of course, now Annie is now gotten in her car and is now being strangled by the masked killer. Which I do admit, I think this is probably the best look that we actually get at the mask now. Which was really interesting. It's actually kind of funny and it's like, oh no, like horror kind of stuff because Annie goes to get into her car. She tries to open the door up and the door's locked. She has to go back and get her keys, but she doesn't go back and unlock the car door. She actually opens it up and then she kind of realizes that, wait a minute, this doesn't seem right. So, and then obviously then she looks in her car. The car's been like all fogged up and whatnot. And then Michael kind of is in the back seat, pops his head up and then just starts choking her. It's actually quite a very, it's actually quite chilling, to be quite honest with you, because because at least the sound design, it's only really like like sound effects and like sound effect that John Carpenter I think came up with, and you know there's not a whole lot of music going on in that scene. It's basically just like Annie just struggling around with that kind of thing. So yeah. So Michael Myers has officially gone from stalker to, you know, full-on strangler killer, so. You can see here, you can see Michael actually carrying Annie's body to the front of her house and, you know, into the door there. This is very interesting sound design, I think. No, oh my, and then Tommy's going on about the boogeyman again. I kind of talked over this shot in the film because there was I think I was talking about something else, but there was, so as I stated previously, Nick Castle is basically the main portrayer of Michael Myers. But there actually were a few other people that portrayed Michael Myers. Actually, there was Deborah Hill, who was the producer. She actually put on the costume one of the days, and she actually portrayed Michael Myers for Jason for like I think literally one scene, and it actually was kind of a joke on when they were making the film, because she was, you know, she's obviously much, she was much shorter than Nick Castle, and they were like, man, the shape is shrunk. That's actually kind of funny. So there was that. I'll get to the next performer. I'll talk about it right now. So, and Tommy Lee Wallace, who the production designer, he portrayed Michael Myers in the very famous closet sequence that, you know, is coming up kind of at the climax of the film. And then I do believe it was the stunt coordinator played him for a scene or two. I forgot who the stunt coordinator's name was, but he played him for a scene or two. So there's the sheriff Lee Brackett, I think played by Charles Cyphers, who reprises the role in Halloween 2, the next Halloween, the Halloween film after this one. And I need to think, but I think he might play the role in the upcoming Halloween film coming up here, because there's actually there's still more Halloween films coming out here. So the next Halloween film, Halloween Kills, coming out basically next October, is Charles Cyphers is actually going to be reprising his role, along with Nancy Stevens, who plays the nurse Marion Chambers in the film here. So yeah. And we have Donald Pleasance, his role as Loomis in this film is actually about the smallest that it is probably in the entire franchise, because, you know, Dr. Loomis becomes quite the mainstay in the Halloween franchise. In fact, basically until Halloween H2O, the first of the reboots of the Halloween franchise. Actually, I think some might say it's the second, but I'll get into the timeline here in a little bit. But basically, for all of the Michael Myers Halloween films, because Halloween 3 doesn't contain a Michael Myers storyline, but for all of the Michael Myers themed Halloween movies, Dr. Sam Loomis is a mainstay, played by Donald Pleasance, until he passed away in 1990, I think it was, and his last film role was Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, so that kind of thing. So now Linda and her boyfriend Bob have gone to the Wallace residence, and now they are obviously a couple of horny teenagers, and they are going to be getting out in on some of that what I could call as a fornicating action. And what they don't really notice, and I love the setup of this scene here, is that Michael, the shape is literally just standing right in the doorway of the living room there, and they're kind of on the couch making out. I always love, like, that they're really mysterious about it. I mean, Michael Myers, one of the things that I always loved about the original Halloweens, and just the first Halloween's portrayal of Michael Myers, and then also the 2018 kind of reboot, as I will call it, is that they're very Michael Myers is very mysterious. There's not a whole lot to his motivation. There's not a whole lot of, you know, why he kills, why he's stalking these particular characters. They're very he's very he's mysterious, you know. And that was the, kind of the idea that John Carpenter wanted when he had Michael, when he was envisioning Michael Myers. He's basically just this, you know, he's not even like a man. I mean, he's basically just like this like force of nature. You know, is he supernatural? Is he not? He left it very vague, you know, basically kind of the theater of the mind, make the audience kind of make it up, that kind of thing. So, so that's kind of, and again, that's also kind of why I say I only like it in this film and then the next film, because as the Halloween films go on, they actually try to build on the mythos of Michael Myers, and they try to like build like a backstory, or they try to give him like motivation of why he kills. And it gets to the point where, like, you know, obviously we learn later that Laurie Strode becomes Michael Myers' sister, which, you know, wasn't the case in this film. Of course, I think that was retconned in Halloween 2, which then was later retconned in the next Halloween. Again, that's kind of how messed up this franchise's timelines are. And then as we got into the later films, you know, Laurie Strode, Halloween's 4 through 6, Laurie Strode had been killed in a car accident, and then she had a daughter named Jamie Lloyd, and then Michael Myers was trying to go after her and kill her. And then we find out essentially that Michael Myers was driven by like some like ancient curse, like the curse of the thorn, which basically meant that he had to like kill his entire bloodline essentially, or else like his, or else like something would happen. Again, I haven't seen any of the Halloween sequels. The only Halloween films I have seen are Halloween 1, Halloween 2, and the 2018 Halloween. I haven't messed around with any of the sequels, any of the reboot H20, H2O, and then its sequel. I didn't even mess around with the Rob Zombie reboot. So it was kind of one of those things. So I kind of like, yeah, this scene here. They got, again, actors and actresses smoking, you know, in a film. Of course, that would never happen nowadays, you know, with the big anti-smoking push. I always love kind of bringing that up in films. Like though the actors and actresses are smoking in the film and whatnot. I'm like, yeah, I don't think that would actually happen in real life now, in today's film. Or if they actually did it in today's film, I'm pretty sure they'd just be like fake cigarettes, because I think people would get kind of up in arms about, you know, them portraying, you know, real life smoking in films nowadays. Of course, that's always something I really bit something funny there. So now Bob, Linda's boyfriend, has gone downstairs and is, you know, obviously it's a very dark and shadowy place. Again, great, wonderful lighting by Dean Cundey, the cinematographer, and, you know, really kind of adding to the mysteriousness of it all. You can kind of hear like Michael's, like, you can kind of hear like the breathing, kind of like, and then he's going to open the door and Michael's going to come straight out and just strangle him to death. It's always kind of funny, like, you know, Michael, you kind of know, like, nowadays, like, you know, Michael Myers is, like, his main kind of weapon of choice is, you know, he's obviously the kitchen, the butcher knife, you know, and this is, I think, the only kill in the film that he actually, you know, kills somebody with a butcher knife, in fact, because, let's think about it, well, that and his sister Judith Myers in the beginning of the film, because if you go to Annie's death, he used the knife on that one. So he uses the knife. And then this one, he actually uses the knife and kind of chokes him out as well. So, now that's actually a bit of a famous shot right there of Nick Castle doing Michael Myers, apparently, because, and I think John Carpenter and Nick Castle kind of came up with this idea of when he kills Linda's boyfriend, Bob, they kind of lift him up, and he sticks the knife through him, and he basically kind of pins him up to the wall. And after that, there's like a wide shot of him kind of looking at him there, and then he's kind of crooking his head like a dog there, and that's kind of become like a bit of a mainstay with the Michael Myers characters, that there's something so removed from him, there's something just so not human, something just so not human about him that it makes it even more terrifying, honestly, because, you know, you see him, and you'll even see him, you know, unmasked in this film. I mean, he is, for all intents and purposes, a human being, but there's something just psychologically not there about him that makes him something not psychologically that's like, I don't know if he's really human, you know, because... But I don't know, so. And so here's Linda going on. Linda is about to get strangled by Michael Myers. Now this scene is actually kind of funny, because I remember PJ Souls was talking about when Michael Myers was a. When Nick Castle, when they were filming the scene, apparently Nick Castle, it kind of took him a while to really, because apparently PJ Souls was like trying to act and what, like trying to be like, you know, I need to get choked out in this film and whatnot, and Nick Castle apparently was just a big kind of like teddy bear. He didn't really want to hurt PJ Souls, because like the kill there was Michael Myers came up behind Linda and essentially took up, and she was, and Linda was talking on the phone cord, was talking on the phone, on the telephone there, and you can hear the telephone there, but Linda and Michael, you can kind of see Michael kind of come up behind Linda there and basically take the telephone cord and wrap it around Linda's neck there and basically just choke her out. And apparently Nick Castle wouldn't put any kind of force on there. Obviously not enough force to, you know, do her any harm and that kind of thing, but, you know, put a little bit of like, you know, just a little bit of, you know, a comfortable amount of pressure there to, you know, give something to act to or something like that. And apparently Nick Castle just wouldn't do that, so... So Michael Myers has now claimed three victims. Very interesting. This film does not have a whole lot of blood, actually. Again, they didn't really have a whole lot... didn't have it in the budget, really, to actually, you know, make... you know, create the blood and, to have blood in the film. So, that's kind of that. And this scene is actually kind of... This scene actually kind of points out a few questions, because basically what they're showing is, so Sam Loomis is still kind of staked out at the Myers house, and he's been basically staked out there all night, and he's been waiting for Michael to come back, and, you know, he looks down the street, and then he finally sees the car that Michael's been, you know, that Michael stole, and it's kind of like, how long have you been standing at that house, and you haven't looked around to see that car there, so... So, I don't know. It's kind of interesting still, so. Yeah, the music's playing. The Halloween theme's playing again, so. I remember Tommy Lee Wallace, who, again, was the editor of the film. He self-described as going crazy from listening to that theme song over and over and over again, because, which I will admit, if you really listen to the music in Halloween, it's really repetitive and really simplistic, and I can imagine how someone would go after listening to it for a while, because there's really only the main theme there, and then there's like this scene right here. Like, of like, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, and then there's, like, some chase music, it's like, dun-dun-dun, dun, dun, dun. And other than that, there's not a whole lot of the variety of music. Just, you know, it's not going to win an Oscar. It's not bad. I'm sounding a little negative about it. The lack of variety of music won't win an Oscar, but also, I think it also fits the film perfectly. It goes along with that kind of minimalistic kind of vibe that, you know, John Carpenter and they kind of created for the film here. So, but I mean, again, like I know some people that, you know, they kind of go crazy listening to the film because it's like it's the same music played over and over and over again. It's like, well, you're kind of true, so you're kind of right. So, I don't know. So Lori's going over to the Wallace house in order to investigate because she kind of heard Linda's kind of moans and wailings that were kind of when she was getting choked out there. So she's obviously concerned for her friends. Not knowing that Michael is currently hiding in that house waiting for her to come in, so. Which some people, you know, obviously this is kind of like the start of that whole, like, characters making bad decisions in movies, and it's like, don't go into that house, you know, you're dumb if you go into that dark house, and don't go do that, and blah, blah, blah. Which I will admit, I think this film, I mean, there's some, like, kind of, like, and obviously, I love in some movies, there's, like, I remember even in Scream, like, one of the main characters was, like, making fun of, like, the never, ever, ever have sex, or you will die, and then all the characters that have sex in this film die. And then, like, never, ever, sever, never, ever say, I'll be right back, and then Bob says, I'll be right back, and then he dies, and that kind of thing, so, so Lori's in the house here all by herself, and I will admit, this is, it's really eerie. I mean, this film, I would say, by today's standards, is very tame, and even in its scares is, you know, obviously, I mean, I've watched this film a couple times. I mean, if I'd watched it the first time, I probably would be kind of scared, but, you know, after seeing this film a couple times, it's kind of like, you know, pretty tame, but it's definitely a creepy, like, atmosphere. I would compare it to The Shining, in which it really creates that, like, creepy atmosphere. Of course, The Shining does a lot more to, like, really build on that atmosphere and really make it more creepier because, I mean, obviously he had more money to do that, you know, with the music and, you know, more camera tricks and whatnot. But, you know, this scene right here, again, it's just, like, very quiet, very dark. You know, again, the cinematography lighting is great and, you know, Lori kind of climbing the stairs, about to go, basically find all our friends dead, you know, in the bedroom there. So, so yeah. It definitely is. It builds the tension, and it's really. It's just like, it really is like keeping you on the edge of your seat, and you're like, don't go in there, or don't do that, or don't do that, and it's really just like, get out of that house now, kind of, you know, kind of screaming at the screen kind of idea. So, here's Lori going into the, she's going to go, opening the door to the bed, to the parents' bedroom. That was also one of the creepy things, is that Linda and Bob were having sex in the Wallace's parents' bedroom. So, and then She finds Annie dead, sprawled out on the bed, with the Judith Myers headstone. I never really understood the significance of having Annie, having Annie's body with the headstone there. I mean, I wonder if Michael always thought that she looked like, you know, his big sister or something like that. But I don't know. I never understood that, really. I mean, I can understand, like, that, you know, Michael Myers is, you know, like one of his big things is like, you know, chasing teenage girls because, you know, his, you know, his thing with his sister and that kind of thing. So this is actually a really interesting scene right here. Lori is standing at the side of a closet door, and Michael is obviously in the shadows there, and there's a little light that kind of Dean Cundey, the cinematographer, kind of had on a dimmer. And the way that it, the way that the scene was kind of constructed is that Michael is like in the shadows there, and the way that like the light goes is that his face is very slowly illuminated, and his face is like very slowly illuminated, and you can kind of see him you slowly see his like face like start to like kind of creep out of the shadows there. Again, another, that's probably one of Dean Cundey's, probably, that's probably his best shot in the entire movie, is that how he slowly showed Michael Myers' face there. So these scenes right here, these always kind of really kind of scare me, like when Michael's like hot on Laurie's trail, and you can really kind of see how like he's almost really getting after her, and it's always also kind of the thing how like Michael's basically walking at a slow pace, and people are trying to run away from him, and he's always able to catch up to her. So this scene was always kind of interesting because Lori is basically going around to like all the neighbors and whatnot, and they're trying to like help. She's trying to call for help, and they basically just kind of shut the blinds on her and just turn the lights off and just decide, nah, we're not going to help you. So that's always what I thought was kind of funny. So because she went to the next door neighbor and was like basically crying out for help and like banging on the door, and they wouldn't nobody would come out and help her out with it. So how did she lose the keys? What the heck? She's back over at the Doyle house where she was babysitting at, and she apparently lost the key. So I don't know how did she lose the key there? And then Michael's obviously coming across the street there. And then Michael's walking across the street. I don't know how he didn't get there in time. I mean, it took Tommy a while to get downstairs and open the door up. Oh, my goodness. And apparently the phone lines have been cut as well. Lori just gets inside just in time before Michael gets to the door, and there's also an open window there, so you're like, oh my gosh, he got in somehow. So that's the thing that I always like about this film. Like, it makes it like plausible, like the way that he can get around. Like, they show like, yeah, there's a cracked window right here. There's like a cracked door kind of in the side there. So it's like, it's not like he's getting into the house like in all these like implausible ways. It's like, it's very kind of like plausible, like the way he can get around and the way he can kind of, you know, the what he can see, like the way that like he can like sneak into people's houses and that kind of thing. So, Lori's gonna check out the body, and because apparently she took like one of her knitting needles, because she was like knitting like a little thing earlier in the film, and she kind of like. And she kind of stuck it in, like, the side of, like, his neck and that kind of thing to try and, you know, obviously stop, ward him off, that kind of thing, so. That's actually one of the kind of the things about the film here is that, or the kind of the origin of Michael Myers is that it's one of the things that adds to the mythos of him, because he's not... Is because, like, you know, you get most humans, if you get stabbed to the neck like that, you're gonna like you might catch one of your main arteries up there and you might bleed out to death, but not Michael Myers. And you know, as we see later in the film here, he's gonna get, you know, stabbed in the chest. He's gonna get shot at. I mean, he's just gonna keep going. So it's one of the first instances of a human kind of slasher antagonist that just, you know, won't die. And you know, it adds to the thing, like, is he human, is he not, like, what's the deal with this guy, that kind of thing. So who knows? And Laurie, obviously Laurie's, you know, hurt, that kind of thing. So I love this scene here, because Tommy, I love the way that the scene's kind of blocked here, is that you can kind of see the shadow in the background of Michael walking up the stairs, and then obviously he's right there in the background. And then, you know, Lori's trying to hide herself in the closet, open the doors up. I will say one thing about Nick Castle that I hadn't able to say yet, but the way that he kind of walks, it's always been something that people kind of talk about, the way that Nick Castle plays the character and the way that he kind of walks. It's kind of like he glides, really, and you know, like kind of his little actions, the head tilts. I mean, it definitely adds to the character, and I think it really is what makes Michael Myers Michael Myers, really. I mean, it's that kind of that gliding, kind of walking presence that, you know, that you know, obviously Nick Castle, I think, you know, did the heavy breathing of Michael Myers in this first film, and it really is what makes Michael Myers a great character, I think. Of course, again, I really like the... Oh yeah, I've said a lot of times I'm a fan of the breathing of the film, but you know, that's obviously, you know, just a little part of it. So as I said earlier, this is the closet scene. Michael is breaking into the closet that Laurie is hiding in, and this is Tommy Lee Wallace wearing the Michael Myers costume. It's not Nick Castle in this scene because they were trying to move fast when doing these scenes here, and Tommy Lee Wallace discovered that they can move pretty fast when doing the scenes here, because when breaking the closet doors, because he could actually, you know, he was the one that designed that closet door, so he could actually you know, bust the closet door open with his hand a lot faster and, you know, get the scene done in basically one take. And I will admit, for the one scene that he did it in, he was a really great, you know, scene of, you know, him and Laurie in the closet breaking the stuff down. So and again, it just really adds to the character of Michael Myers. I mean, it's just kind of his aggression, when, because you just kind of see him, he's just kind of a guy that's just, he moves really methodically, he moves really slowly, not a whole lot of maybe deliberation to his actions or that kind of thing. He's a bit slower. And then when he gets time to actually, like, you know, harming people and, like, you know, hurting people, he gets really aggressive. He's going to, like, you know, bash stuff down. He's going to, like, choke you out, that kind of thing. And, again, that's really what just makes the character all that more terrifying. So I will admit, I mean, and I haven't seen the Nightmare on Elm Street films. I haven't seen the Friday the 13th films. I haven't seen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre films. I am not a horror film fan at all. I don't go out of my way to watch horror films. I mean, I would say Halloween is really the only horror film that I really go out to watch, but I would say Michael Myers is probably, in my estimation, the best and the scariest of the slasher film, you know, antagonists. There's another great little shot of Nick Castle and Michael Myers there, because great shot of Michael Myers, because basically Laurie is in the foreground of the shot there, and Michael, and they kind of show her kind of like taking a little bit of rest after she kind of stabbed him in the chest there, and you kind of see like Michael Myers like in the background kind of still laying down, and then he kind of sits up, and then he does a little turn to Laurie. And I always love, like, and even this scene right here, Laurie, I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is in the foreground here she's in focus, and then kind of, you know, using the brilliance of the widescreen format, you know, you can kind of show somebody in a, kind of in the background out of focus, and that really kind of adds to like the terrifying kind of aspect to that. And again, another kind of brilliant bit of kind of body acting by Nick Castle to do that kind of sit up and turn action. And Michael Myers is unmasked. They finally see the man under the mask, and they show that it is a man. The actor that played that was actually Tony Moran. They didn't really want to use Nick Castle's face when they were doing that, so they did Tony Moran, who basically did it for that one scene, and I don't think he's done it again. So Donald Pleasance, Dr. Loomis, has now shot Michael Myers a few times, and he has now fallen off the balcony. So, and I do believe it was 6 or 7 times that Loomis shot Michael in the chest and the heart, that kind of thing. So, and then Laurie's like, "Is that the boogeyman?" And like, Dr. Loomis was, it was, so. And then the final shot here of Loomis looking out over the balcony, and then he realizes, Michael Myers is not there. Now, apparently, according to John Carpenter, there were two ways that they could have played this. They could have either played it, "Oh my God, I knew this was going to happen," or "Oh my God, he's gone." Like, he basically, Loomis was like going to look all seriousness out into the night, like kind of have that serious like look on his face, like, "Oh my God, I knew this would happen," kind of look, which is ultimately what it went with, and it really makes the end of the film all that more chilling. And then this final montage here, basically just kind of showing all the locations that Michael Myers has been, and it's really, really it's really chilling, because you can hear that breathing, and that's why I really like the breathing of the film, because it really indicates that he's around, and you know, it's basically going to tell you that, you know, he's everywhere. You know, I mean, he could be anywhere at this point. You know, he's still out there, and you know, who knows where he's at. And obviously, as we'll learn in the next film, you know, he's going to be, you know, still out there, and he's still going to be going around killing people. So, and that, we get to the credits, Halloween. So yeah, that's Halloween, the first movie, and you know, a lot to unpack with this film. I mean, it's the film that ultimately, a lot of people will say that, you know, this is the film that really ushered in the modern era of horror, you know, of the slasher genre. You know, people will say that, you know, there was, you know, horror pre-Halloween and post-Halloween. You know, I think it's a film that's, it's within, Jim Winburn, that was the stunt coordinator that played Michael Myers. That was a bit of an aside, but I'm watching the credits here, but you know, certain movies, you know, in the 60s and 70s that really kind of, you know, were the dawn of the modern horror age. I think, you know, several of those movies were, you know, Psycho by Alfred Hitchcock, and then Night of the Living Dead by George Romero, you know, for the zombie aspect, and then, you know, Michael Myers, and then Halloween for the slasher genre. So I mean, you know, but again, it's such a legendary film, and I mean, at the time when it was released, it was one of the most, at first when it was released, it actually wasn't doing very well with reviews and with, you know, box office returns. It wasn't doing all that great, and, you know, there were some negative reviews that came back, but it actually was saved by a review by Roger Ebert, who, again, is one of the most well-respected, you know, film critics of all time, you know, since passed away, but very, very well-respected film critic, and he gave the film a glowing review. And, you know, he was very complimentary of the film and complimentary of its scares and all that kind of thing. So, and that's also what saved the film. And the film, I think, went on to gross $70 million, I do believe. Let me see here. Let me try and... So, it went on to gross upwards of $70 million. And at the time, it was one of the most successful independent films of all time. I mean, it was an independent film, independently produced and distributed. So, and of course, $70 million on the backdrop of a $325,000 budget, $70 million. I mean, that's making a lot of money. That's a lot of money that film made there. And then in doing so, it really caused the studio to want to make sequels. John Carpenter was not was really not interested in doing sequels to Halloween. Erwin Yablans and Mustafa Akkad, the two kind of executive main producers of the film, you know, they wanted to do sequels, and John Carpenter really didn't want to do a sequel. And it was actually kind of an interesting court case, because John Carpenter was going to do a film called The Fog with Erwin Yablans' production company, and this film was Compass International Pictures, and then later was changed to Trankus International Pictures. But John Carpenter actually went to another production company and was going to do his next movie, The Fog, with them. And, you know, they had already had an agreement that they would do The Fog with Erwin Yablans. And basically, Erwin Yablans was frustrated that John Carpenter took The Fog to another production studio. And then he essentially sued Carpenter. And basically, Carpenter could still make The Fog with that production company. But he had to make Halloween 2 with Erwin Yablans, and he didn't direct Halloween 2. It was directed by Rick Rosenthal, which was his feature film directorial debut. But John Carpenter wrote the film along with Deborah Hill, and he produced it. Apparently, when he was writing the film, he said he would write it with a six-pack of beer, because it was just really hard for him to get through, because he really didn't want to make the film. He didn't really think it was the sequel to Halloween was worth making. And Halloween 2, I would say, out of all the sequels, I think is the best one. I think it's the only one that I've seen, but it's really because Halloween 2, it just basically follows on. It basically is a continuation of that night, of Halloween night. And it basically follows Laurie to the Haddonfield Memorial Hospital, and Michael finds out that she's there, and you know, he goes there, and it's basically like a Halloween hospital chase movie throughout the hospital. And that film, And the movie's over, and I'm actually this is actually going to be a little different, because I actually have a lot more to talk about, kind of unpack with this film, because this film franchise is very interesting in its history, and the way that it's such a messed up history, but it's also really interesting. So at the end of Halloween 2, it ends with basically a giant explosion in the hospital, and that explosion was supposed to be the end of Dr. Loomis and Michael Myers. Basically, the ending is, you know, Dr. Loomis, like, he fills the room with gas, with, like, this, you know, flammable gas. He lights a lighter on fire, and it basically blows the room up. And you can kind of see Michael on fire stumbling out of the room, and then he finally falls down and, you know, kind of succumbs to his injuries. And that was supposed to be the end of Michael Myers, but, and for a while it was. In 1982, In 1982, I think it was 1982, or it may have been later, they made another Halloween film, another Halloween movie, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, and this was when John Carpenter and Deborah Hill didn't really want to continue the story of Michael Myers, and they wanted the series of Halloween to be kind of like an anthology series of films. Like, they wanted to do like a different like kind of like story, like every single year, or every single like movie, based around the Halloween, you know, franchise, like the Halloween idea of, you know, being on Halloween. But Season of the Witch didn't really do that well at the box office. It wasn't really well received by critics. I have never personally seen it, and I don't really have a whole lot of intention to see it, to be quite honest with you. I've heard that as its own film, it's actually not that bad, but of course, again, I mean, the audience, the indicator was clear. I mean, no Michael Myers, I mean, nobody would go to see it, so they decided to bring back Michael Myers, kind of a reboot. I would say this is probably the first reboot of the franchise when they brought back Michael Myers. John Carpenter, Deborah Hill decided to not continue with it. And Mustafa Akkad, who was basically became the sole owner of the Halloween franchise, who originally had gave the $325,000 to the production to get the film made. He essentially took over as the main kind of basically the main producer of the series, and they produced. And during this time, they did Halloween 4, did Halloween 5, and then Halloween 6. And these four sequels are probably the low points of the Halloween franchise, because Halloween 4 started off apparently as a solid movie. I've never seen these movies, but from what I heard, Halloween 4 was probably the best out of this trilogy, because these three films kind of they make a little bit of a trilogy, of a story arc about Michael Myers being kind of involved, like in this cult, and like how he's like driven by this curse to kill all his bloodline, and instead of following Laurie Strode, we're actually following Laurie's daughter Jamie Lloyd, and basically her foster family, and basically, you know, Michael's trying to kill Jamie now, but then Jamie's also having some of the same problems that Michael is, you know, going catatonic and starting to like kill people, all that kind of stuff. So Halloween 4 started off okay. Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers, that one wasn't as well received. And then Halloween 6, which was actually produced by Dimension Films, that had a whole bunch of, you know, production issues. It had a whole bunch of just, reshoots that were required, all kinds of, you know, issues with the production. That film was widely panned. It actually is kind of interesting, because Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, it has the theatrical cut, which was heavily edited, heavily different than what the original version was. And then it has what's called the producer's cut, which is much different from the version that was released in theaters, but it has a lot more to do with the kind of cult side of, like, Michael Myers, and it's like, very heavy on the occult and very heavy on that kind of stuff, and I'm not really into that. And from all accounts, like, both films are just not very good, and it's just, you know, not even worth kind of watching at this point. Interesting note, The Curse of Michael Myers, I think, is the first one of the first feature theatrical appearances of Paul Rudd, who obviously, as we all know now, is the portrayal, the man that plays Ant-Man, Scott Lang. He also played one of those reporters in Anchorman. I forget which one it was. And all throughout this time, Halloween 4 and 6, Jamie Lee Curtis was not in these films. He didn't want anything to do with Halloween. In the 20 years since, in between her appearances, you know, she had, you know, skyrocketed in the film industry. You know, she became a really successful actress, you know, a lot of, you know, great titles to her name. But 20 years after the first film was released, they actually rebooted the franchise. This is essentially the first major kind of reboot of the franchise. I kind of said that the fourth one was the first kind of reboot of the franchise, but this one is truly a reboot, where they literally are like, where they're basically are retconning that the last four films hadn't been made at all. Basically, Halloween H2O, 20 years later, is essentially considered a direct sequel to Halloween 2. It basically treats Halloween 4 and 6 as if they had never happened before, and this will become a theme as we'll go along here. And Halloween H2O is essentially Halloween 20 years later. H2O is essentially about Laurie Strode. You know, Jamie Lee Curtis reprises her role, and essentially she is kind of, you know, changed her name, went into hiding, you know, started had a son, and, you know, she's running like this boarding school, and Michael Myers kind of, you know, tracks her down, is able to track her down, because he, in the direct sequel to the second film, he wasn't killed in that big explosion, you know, same as in the fourth film, he wasn't killed in that big explosion. Him and Dr. Loomis weren't killed in that same explosion. In the second film, in Halloween H2O, coming from the explosion there in the end of Halloween 2 there, he wasn't killed. He basically kind of disappeared after that fire, and he essentially has been spent the last 20 years looking for Laurie Strode and looking around and all that kind of stuff. And basically, he catches up to Laurie Strode at his school, at her boarding school, and he goes around, you know, killing people and all that kind of stuff. And then finally, at the end of that movie, Laurie Strode apparently kills Michael Myers, and then there's another sequel to that film, Halloween Resurrection, in which Michael Myers is not killed, and he comes back, and he you know, kill some more. And, you know, Halloween H2O was considered probably the best sequel since Halloween 2. And, of course, I haven't seen that one. I don't really have a whole lot of interest in seeing Halloween H2O, but, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis being back in the franchise really helped them out there. But Halloween Resurrection, which was the direct sequel to Halloween H2O, Halloween 20 years later, H2O, as it's called a lot, that film didn't do a whole lot. That film didn't do very well either. Because it, from what I heard, it was basically a really stupid premise of, like, Halloween Resurrection was essentially a film in which, a group of people, like, do, like, this, like, stay the night kind of TV show in, like, in the Myers house, and Michael goes back to the Myers house, and while they're doing that TV show, he basically kills off the people in that house, and Busta Rhymes is in that film, and apparently he has, like, this really stupid karate, like, fight with Michael Myers, and it's kind of stupid, so that was kind of the last one of the kind of old timeline of Michael Myers, and that was actually, unfortunately, the last film produced by Mustafa Akkad, who unfortunately was killed in a terrorist bombing, I think in 2005. And his son Malik Akkad took over producing the franchise. And in 2007, the whole franchise was rebooted, big scratching reboot. And it wasn't that it was a sequel to any of the previous films. It was literally a redo of it was a remake of the original Halloween. It was directed and written by Rob Zombie, and he basically made the film his own again. It was basically a remake of the film that we had just watched here. The one thing about that film that, you know, I haven't seen it. I don't really have any plans to see it. But the one thing about that film that people kind of poo-poo on, and I kind of agree with them on this, is that it spends a lot of time in making Michael Myers and doing a lot more characterization of Michael Myers. You saw him a lot more as a kid. You kind of saw a lot of the events leading up to what made him, you know, start killing people and, you know, become kind of that becoming like the psychopath that, you know, we all know and love. Maybe not love, but you know what I'm talking about. But that was basically the first half of the film was like him as a kid. And then the second half of the film is essentially just like a, you know, basically just, you know, beat for beat remake of the film that we watched here. The whole idea with Michael Myers is that you don't know what's behind the mask and you really don't know what's going on there. So it's really, and in that case, I'm not really interested in watching those films because I'm more of a fan of the Michael Myers that we don't really know his clear motives. And, you know, in these two, in the Rob Zombie Halloween movies, really, they tried to build a good backstory with him. And Rob Zombie, I mean, he tried to make it his own, and I applaud him for that, but it's just something that I'm not really interested in, don't really have an interest in seeing. I know it's kind of me judging a book by its cover by saying, oh, I'm not going to watch that movie, and I'm not really into that, but from what I've heard, it's the first Halloween is essentially just a rehash of this one, and the second Halloween that he made, the Halloween 2, is essentially the other Halloween 2, not the original 1981 Halloween 2, but the next Halloween 2 is basically just not a good movie at all. So I do not have any intentions of watching that. Now, just recently, in 2018, there was another Halloween film that was released, and this one is just simply titled Halloween. And it's really, now again, that's kind of where the confusion of this franchise comes in. There's been three movies named Halloween. This one that we just saw, and then the 2007 remake, and then the 2018, what I would call rebootquel. Now, the 2018 one, it kind of follows a little bit of the same beats as the 2000, Halloween H2O 20 years later. But in this one, instead of being a direct sequel from Halloween 2, this film, Halloween 2018, as I will call it now, is basically a direct sequel from the film that we just watched here. It acts as if Halloween 2 didn't happen. Basically, at the end of this movie, you kind of saw that, you know, Dr. Loomis went and shot Michael Myers six times, and he fell off the balcony. Well, basically, according to the 2018 canon, Michael Myers gets captured that night after he falls off the balcony. He gets taken back to Smith's Grove Sanitarium, and then he basically just waits there for another 40 years until he kills again. Again, Halloween 2018 stars Jamie Lee Curtis's Laurie again. I think it's a better portrayal of this is one that I've actually watched, and it's the first Halloween film since Halloween 3, the first Michael Myers film since Halloween 2 that actually involves the direct involvement of John Carpenter. He was the executive. He was, I think, a creative consultant. He was one of the executive producers. He also scored the film, which he actually did a bit of an update to his original score. But yeah, in Halloween 2018, I'd say it's a good, it's a solid film. I don't think it's as good. It's basically a bit of a rehash of this one. It's kind of the same idea that The Force Awakens had in kind of redoing A New Hope, but it's still a pretty solid film. I mean, you know, compared to all of the other films that have been released in the Halloween series, it's definitely a highlight of that. So, but again, that's just kind of the idea that that's just kind of a general idea of this franchise of how it's just been so there's just been so much that's been going on in it, and it's been rebooted again, and it's a bit of a mess of a franchise, and you can kind of get lost in it. You know, there's some timeline. I mean, there's literally like three different timelines that you can follow with the original canon. You know, there's also the remake timeline that you want to follow. That you can do that, but it's really, but it can get a tad confusing. And you know, for some people, it's like, oh, it's a lot of Michael Myers, but I mean, what the good Halloween movies, I think, are pretty dang good. And you know, again, I think it's one of my favorite slasher. I think it's really the only slasher, you know, series that I've seen. And again, I don't really have any interest in seeing any of the other slasher films. So, and shoot, that's probably where I'm going to leave it. Again, that's probably the most I'm ever going to talk after the film is finished. I mean, I just had a lot to talk about, kind of the history of the film franchise, and that kind of thing. So yeah, that's basically all. That's where I'm going to end it. And that is the end of Halloween month of October. I'm going to kind of go back to doing more kind of conventional movies. I mean, I'll probably do a horror film. Try and do more horror films. I know, and I alluded to the film earlier in this podcast, I'm eventually going to want to do The Thing, that another John Carpenter film. That's another great film that I want to do. And I have a couple other ideas that I want to do. I have a couple requests that I have to get to. That's where I'm going to leave it at. Thank y'all so much for listening to the podcast. Thank y'all for watching on YouTube. If you listen this far, and I should have said this earlier in the film, there might be a little recording blurb that I put at the beginning of this, because I really want to push this. But my last podcast that I did, Night of the Living Dead, watch the YouTube version. Go on the YouTube channel there's a link in the description below. Go to the Night of the Living Dead podcast. You can literally watch the Night of the Living Dead with the commentary that I did of it. It's really cool. I really highly recommend that you check it out. If you can't find it, follow me on Instagram @TheMovieCommentaryPodcast. The link to that YouTube video is in the bio. You know, also if you go to the Night of the Living Dead, you know, episode, there's a link to the YouTube video in there as well. But really highly recommend the Night of the Living Dead YouTube video, because that is probably the only one that you can actually watch the whole movie along with the commentary recorded over it. All right, that's where I'm going to leave it off with you guys. Thank you guys so much for listening. Hopefully we can keep this going for the rest of the year. Hope stay golden out there, y'all, and I will see you on the flip side.